This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Smart Food Popcorn. Some decisions aren't the best, like skipping ahead in your favorite podcast. Think of all the banter you'll miss, the lore in the making. Luckily, Smart Food Popcorn is a no-brainer. Deliciously tasty and available in a variety of fun flavors. It's a smart decision every time. Smart Food. Add smart. To learn more, visit smartfood.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, I'm Oliver Condy, the editor of BBC Music Magazine, and welcome to the BBC Music Podcast. You can buy a copy of the magazine at your local newsagents or download our app to your iPad, Kindle Fire or Android tablet. And for the latest music news and more, head to our website at classical-music.com.
This week, we've gathered together members of the BBC Music Magazine editorial team for First Listen, a monthly slot where we chat about and rate an important new release. You'll have noticed from the change of voice that I am not Oliver Condy. I am, in fact, the deputy editor, Jeremy Pound. And with me in the studio today are our reviews editor, Rebecca Franks.
Bonjour.
And our online editor and staff writer, Rosie Pentruth.
Howdy.
This month, we've been listening to Broadway Lafayette, a new disc on the Sony Classical label, in which American pianist Simone Dinnerstein plays Ravel's Piano Concerto in G, Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, and Lasser's The Circle and the Child, all accompanied by the MDR Leipzig Radio Symphony Orchestra under conductor Christian Nievi. We'll begin with a bit of the Ravel. This disc, as Simone Dinnerstein explains in the sleeve notes, and as the title implies, celebrates the cross of cultures between the US and France. And so we begin with the jazz-inflected Piano Concerto in G by Ravel, a Frenchman inspired by all things American. Then we move on to The Circle and the Child, a piano concerto by the contemporary composer Philip Lasser, who is half French, half American. And we round off with The Rhapsody in Blue by the Paris-loving George Gershwin. The Ravel and Gershwin will doubtless be familiar with many listeners, the latter won't, as it's a world premiere recording. So, let's take things in the order as they come on the disc. We just heard a moment from the beginning of the first movement of the Ravel Concerto. Rebecca, can you just fill us in a little with the history of this piece?
Yes, so this concerto was written between 1929 and 1931. Ravel had, in fact, just been on a concert tour of the US. He'd taken in sort of over 20 American cities. It was a piano tour, and he really enjoyed the whole experience. In fact, he loved seeing the big American cities, encountering that way of life, and especially hearing the music. It was here he encountered jazz. He heard Gershwin's musical Funny Face. He actually met Gershwin, as well as other figures, including Kreisler and Bartok. And I think he just, what he liked about it actually was he wasn't composing when he was on that trip. He was playing the piano, and I think the routine kind of, he really enjoyed that. He felt very sort of at ease there. But when he came back, he'd encountered jazz, we say, and that really makes its mark on this concerto.
And so what we might expect from a performance of this concerto is a little bit of New York American jazz and pizzazz combined with a touch of typical Ravelian Gallic delicacy and sophistication. Do you reckon we get this on this disc, Rosie?
Well, it's certainly very energetic, kind of from the start. You've got this, especially in the orchestra, you've got this weightiness, but it's still quite kind of bright and connected. So it does kind of recall that brash New York jazzy kind of feel in the first movement, I think, for me. But I feel when Dinnerstein enters, there could have been a tiny bit more character. And throughout the whole concerto, actually, it feels like she may actually not have heard that much jazz. Now, the sort of true authentic jazz of jazz bars, you know, late at night when the musicians have been playing together for years and you just hear this amazing kind of spontaneity. Of course, it's not for me to say she probably has listened to it, but I just felt with the performances, it felt like she hadn't. As for the kind of refinement you were talking about from the typical Ravel, you'd expect that to come through perhaps in this gorgeous second movement. Again, I felt there could have been slightly more character in Dinnerstein's playing. I was waiting for some real warmth in the sort of sustained phrases. And then when she begins the kind of circling semi-quavers, you again expect a tiny bit more warmth, I think, here, and some more nuances in the phrasing. But it is nice and delicate against the sort of sustained orchestral parts. Yeah, she's very good technically. I mean, she's got good technical command of the fast movements and the slow movement, I would say. So yeah, it does come through slightly.
What did you make of it, Rebecca?
For me, it did slightly lack the sort of Gallic delicacy that you were talking about there. This is a piece that has been recorded so many times. So, you know, it's one that the competition is very strong. And I think of recent performances, for example, by the French pianist Jean-Ephraim Bavuzet, which really has that ebullience and sparkle. And Benjamin Grosvenor's recent performance, which is, again, has this wonderful magical quality that I slightly missed that in this performance, I must say. I felt this was a much, I think you used the word weightier, it was a much sort of heavier performance in a way. And for Ravel, for me, that's not quite the spirit of the music.
Yes, it didn't quite have the sort of etherealness that you need to have in that second movement, where you kind of, the second movement should really float a bit, whereas this one sounded just a touch too deliberate. That said, I actually did quite enjoy the drama which she brings to the first movement. I thought that had quite a lot of impact. Anyway, let's have another moment from Simone Dinnerstein's performance of the Ravel then. Here's a bit from the Divine Second Movement. And now we move on to the world premiere on the disc, Philip Lasser's The Circle and the Child. Rosie, can you tell us a little bit about Lasser and his concerto?
Like you say, Jeremy, Philip Lasser is a living composer. He's half American and half French. He was born in New York and has written several works for orchestra, as well as some piano pieces and choral and chamber music. He's actually written a piece for Simone Dinnerstein before, 12 variations on a Bach chorale, which he wrote in 2008, and she's also recorded. Again, this concerto is based on a Bach chorale. Loosely, he explains that the five notes heard at the beginning that kind of recur throughout the concerto can be found deep in this chorale, which is Bach's Ehrgestein, Erhöhen Luft. You stars in heaven, you vaulted sky.
Well, let's have a little moment from the first movement of the work in question, Philip Lass's The Circle and the Child. Well, there it is. I must admit that, for me, Lasser doesn't do himself a lot of favours with his slightly twee guide to the work in the sleeve notes. Take, for example, his description of his use of that Bach chorale which you mentioned, Rosie. "Like an exquisite perfume," he writes, "Bach's chorale emanates from every passage of my concerto. One hears the chorale as an intimate confession from the piano in dialogue with itself and its orchestral double through the fears and loves of a child." Rebecca, did you hear all that as you listened?
I must admit that note also slightly set me on edge before I'd even put the CD on. I'm not quite sure what I would expect from that, but Bach is at the heart of the piece, but there's nothing, you shouldn't expect anything kind of like the sort of contrapuntal development or rigour of Bach's music here. That's not the world we're kind of in. If I'm being completely honest, very few details, apart from that opening little scale motif, really stuck in my mind as I listened to this. I found it quite hard work to really sort of grasp, and I've sort of jotted down a few things as I was listening to it that it kind of reminded me of, just to help sort of set it in context. The very first thing I thought was it really reminded me of a Christmas advert for a sort of a major supermarket or a department store. In the middle movement, I thought that was actually perhaps the best of the three movements. It was slightly more ambiguous, sort of emotionally ambiguous territory. It reminded me a little bit of Finzi at moments, a little bit of Ravel, Mother Goose, and some of the ways the colours pass between the wind instruments. And there were things I liked about in the first movement, it just kind of, that scale just scurries off the page and we're just left in this sort of space. And in the third movement, there's a little bit more bite because he sort of uses two keys at once. So there were sort of things that stood out for me. But as a general piece, it's not one that I found really, just, it hasn't really stuck with me, I've got to say.
And what did you make of it, Rosie?
Yeah, exactly. Just like Rebecca said, it didn't stick with me, and I found that opening motif really repetitive. And exactly like you said, actually, that's kind of what stayed with me.
I must admit that coming to the end of the disc and having listened to the work several times, I didn't find that I really knew that much about Lasser as a composer. I couldn't quite work out what his individual voice was. There's moments in the last movement where you think, oh, this is sounding quite nice, going somewhere, and he does that strange thing of, I guess he's obviously, this is intentional, but he lulls you into this lovely sense of security and then sticks in some dissonance. But it sounded almost a little bit contrived at times, that he was kind of doing it for the sake of it. Let's then hear a passage from that final movement of Lasser's concerto, and this movement is titled Circles.
Thank you.
To finish, we're going to return to an altogether more familiar work, Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. You all know that famous opening well. That was the opening of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, of course, and it was performed here by the MDR Leipzig Radio Symphony Orchestra with Simone Dinnerstein at the piano. What's always worth remembering about the Rhapsody is it was originally written for big band, Paul Whiteman's big band in 1924, to be exact, and then was orchestrated later by Ferdy Grofe, and it's that orchestration that we normally hear today in most recordings. Some of those recordings tend to wallow in the large orchestral forces, others aim to retain an element of the big band feel. What do you reckon we get here, Rebecca?
Well, to my ears, we got a performance that emphasised the sort of classical rather than the jazz side of this concerto, which I guess is in keeping with the theme of the disc. So the Ravel being a classical composer that was influenced by jazz, and then the other way around, I suppose, for Gershwin. I slightly missed, if I'm completely honest, some of that jazz feel. There were very broad and spacious tempos in her performance of the Gershwin. But I thought, you know, they did a really nice job with all the different colours of the orchestra, and everything was sort of very musically done.
Excellent. And what do you think, Rosie?
Yeah, I think any kind of appreciation of this piece is very personal, isn't it? And like Rebecca, I missed the jazz, really. I felt like it could have been more spontaneous, and especially Dinnerstein, I felt she was very classical. But yeah, like you say, it's in keeping with the disc. I just miss the jazz and the kind of energy.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to completely buck the trend here and say I actually really enjoyed this performance. I thought it was very sophisticated and actually quite a Gallic performance of it. I've heard more performances than I care to mention, and an awful lot of them kind of crashed through in a very sort of excitable way. And I've got nothing against that, but I just love this because it was a real change from that. It was a very thoughtful account. You felt that she was really kind of taking her time. As you say, the tempos are quite broad, and she was kind of taking in the scenery around her and kind of smelling the coffee, if you like. Very deliberate at times, but none the worse for that, I have to say. For me, it's certainly a performance I'll be returning to quite a lot, I think. Anyway, let's hear a little more of it, shall we? Here's a moment from near the end of Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. Now that we've happily pounded the streets of 1920s New York, all that remains is for us to give our scores. Rebecca, what do you give this disc?
I'd like to give this disc a 6 out of 10. I thought it was perfectly good playing, perfectly very musical, but it just, for me, didn't sparkle, and the Ravel really does need to sparkle. The latter I didn't particularly take to as a piece of music, and the Gershwin I did enjoy, so I think for me that was probably the strongest part of the disc. But yes, I just felt it could have had that extra bit of inspiration and Gallic sort of fizz.
Rosie?
It's a 6 for me as well. Obviously 6 points for a world premiere recording, which is interesting, and fantastic technical playing. But like I've said throughout, I kind of missed the jazz in places and the kind of energy.
Well, I'm going to give it 7 out of 10 because I found it a bit of a curate's egg of a disc. The Ravel I enjoyed, but it never really blew me away. The latter, I'm afraid to say, I found really rather forgettable, if I'm honest. And then, as I say, I really enjoyed that Gershwin, and I shall be listening to it an awful lot more. So that's a 7 out of 10 from me, and that gives us a total of 19, which means there's three of us in the studio today, means an average of 6 1/3. And that brings us to the end of this month's First Listen. Do join us next month. We'll be getting together once more to discuss another major recording. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this BBC Music Magazine podcast, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Jack Fletcher. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at classical-music.com or simply head to iTunes.